TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Great War for Civilization. The Conquest of the Middle East. Robert Fisk has lived in and reported on the Middle East since 1976 and has seen or tracked down first-hand accounts of all the major events of the last quarter century. He speaks Arabic and has a keen understanding of both the plight of ordinary people and the machinations of extraordinary villains and politicians. In his talk about his new book, The Great War for Civilization, Robert Fisk offers his thoughts on the most urgent issues of our day. From the Algerian War, the Israel-Palestine War, the invasion of Afghanistan, the sanctions on Iraq, and the spread of depleted uranium, each invasion by the new and old colonial powers has made Muslims more angry of the West. In light of decades of bloodshed, Fisk says how surprised he is, how restrained Muslims have been with us. In 1917, it was Britain that invaded Iraq, claiming to be the liberator. Britain was driven out by the insurgency after great loss of life. Now it is the United States. Will we be able to learn from history? Here is Robert Fisk, recorded at a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance in Berkeley, California, in November 2005.
I'm not going to give you a hard sell on my book tonight, but I would like to try and tell you about what it was like to write it and what I learned about the Middle East by writing it. And what I discovered at the end was the purpose of the book. I think I only realized this when I was writing the last pages. But I think what I was trying to do in The Great War for Civilization, and I'll be using this for quotation marks tonight, which tells you a lot about the Middle East. I think what I was trying to do was to persuade people to refuse to accept the narrative of history as it is set out for us by our presidents and prime ministers and generals and by our journalists. One of the central characters in my book, actually in the center of the book, not a character throughout, is my own father, William Fisk, or Bill Fisk as he was known. Bill Fisk was much older than my mother, and so in 1918, at the age of 19, he found himself a soldier fighting in the Second Battle of the Somme in the First World War. He was sent to the trenches of France near Albert and Arras. And when he died, aged 93, in 1992, I inherited his campaign medal. On the back were engraved the words, "The Great War for Civilization." And when I received the medal, I realized that, ironically, it had to be the title of my book. My father thought he was fighting the Great War for Civilization. Well, he did think that until he read the diaries of General Haig and the other British and French commanders and realized that they had lied and that the lions had been sent to die by donkeys. But in the 17 months that followed my father's First World War, in just 17 months, the victors, the British and the French, drew the borders of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and most of the Middle East. And I have spent my entire professional career as a journalist in Belfast and Bosnia and Belgrade and Baghdad and Beirut, watching the people in those borders burn and suffer. This was a deeply depressing book to write. The first 200 pages were quite good fun. I had a French researcher who'd gone through 328,000 pages of notebooks, documents, files, propaganda leaflets dropped from aeroplanes, everything that my magpie instinct as a journalist had got together every month and stuffed into laundry bags of third-rate hotels. And when she brought to me the first notebooks of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the descendants of Stalingrad and the snows of the Hindu Kush, the Iranian Revolution, the first days of the Iran-Iraq War, there was a kind of schoolboy adventure for me in all this. When my foreign editor first asked me to be the Middle East correspondent of the Times, this is pre-Murdoch, before the Papi Vore came to eat the Times, the paper eater, I was in Portugal covering the aftermath of the Portuguese Revolution, and I received a letter from Louis Herron saying that our Middle East correspondent, Paul Martin, was leaving Beirut because he'd just married a billionaire German princess who did not want to spend the early years of her married life in a war. He said to me, "It will be a great adventure and there'll be lots of sunshine." On the Shatt al-Arab River, which divides Iran from Iraq, in 1980, a British ship found itself marooned. And through reasons too complex and too boring to explain, my colleague John Snow of Independent Television News, now a very famous anchorman on Channel 4 television in Britain, was asked to rescue the crew at night from the ship. He got hold of a bunch of Iraqi commandos, and these days, of course, we wanted Iraq to invade Iran, so the Iraqi soldiers, rather than being war criminals, were elite units. We loved the Iraqi army then. We set off over this half-sunken date plantation island at night, mosquitoes buzzing around us, bullets whizzing by every so often at hip height when the dogs went and alerted the Iranians that there were some horrible foreigners there. And John eventually swam out in flippers and with the Iraqi commando squad, got the crew onto their lifeboat, and Fisk pulled the lifeboat in from the island on a hawser with the crew on board. Being a British ship, most of the crew was Sri Lankan and Indian. In any event, they were all rescued. John made his movie. I took it out, along with my report for the Times, to Kuwait and then by air to Amman. So in the morning, when I woke up at the Jordanian Amman Intercontinental Hotel, there was a telex. No emails in those days. There was a telex beneath my door from my foreign desk. It said, "Why you no swam shark-infested Shatt al-Arab River?" When I finished writing this section of the book, and it's all there, I took it to a very dear friend of mine and read it to them, and she said, "It's beautiful, what happens now?" And I said, "There's nothing else happy in the book. From now onwards, it's a story of death, tragedy, betrayal, injustice, torture, dictatorship, ethnic cleansing, genocide." And she said, "Ah, that is the end of the sweet stories." And so the paragraph after this adventure begins, "There is the end of the sweet stories." And I fear that writing this book became ever more depressing. One of the things I found actually in concluding this book, which includes the Algerian War, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the invasion of Afghanistan, the Iran-Iraq War, the Kuwait invasion, the depleted uranium, sanctions on Iraq, and so on. One of the things I realized when I got to the end is how surprised I was at how restrained Muslims had been with us. Not the opposite, but how restrained they'd been. But it was a very depressing book to write. One day my researcher came down to my library and just said to me, "Robert, we're going for a walk on the beach and I'm going to buy you a pint of Guinness in the pub. Get away from it. Leave. It's not a happy book and I never want to write a book like this again." I'm not sure, in retrospect, what our job as a foreign correspondent really should be, although I have a suspicion I know. I used to think, in those happy days when I was 29 and 30, that our job was to record the first pages of history, that we would write those first pages, that we would see wars before anyone else did, that no one else could say, "We didn't know, no one told us." But more than 2 years ago in Jerusalem, when I was talking to Amira Haas, that very fine Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz, and whose work, by the way, is more eloquent and more courageous than any other Western reporters out of the Middle East. And she said, "No, Robert, you're wrong. Our job is to monitor the centers of power." Those were her words, "to monitor the centers of power, to challenge authority, especially when they go to war, especially when they're going to kill people, and especially when they do lies to do it." And I think that remains the best description of our job, or of what our job should be, that I've ever heard. Amira's own description comes from her mother's experience in the Second World War. Her mother, who of course was Jewish, was a partisan with Tito's forces in resisting the Nazi occupation of Yugoslavia. I think she came from the town of Cetinje. And at one point during the war, the Germans occupied the town and said that they would shoot all the women in the town unless Amira's mother surrendered, which of course she did. She was taken prisoner by the Gestapo and sent to concentration camp in Germany. And she had, according to Amira, this extraordinary experience of one day walking up from the rail yard to the camp, up a middle-class German road. And the German housewives, who'd just finished breakfast, were walking out of the house very carefully and neatly dressed, middle-class area, drying their cups and their saucers and their cutlery, and stood at the front gate and watched the Jewish prisoners coming up the road. And Amira said, the one thing I cannot stand is people who stand aside and watch. People who stand aside and watch. How many times, as a journalist, I've watched people stand aside and watch. The book, I suppose, is also a kind of warning. I recall in it how, in 1992, I made a film series for Discovery Channel and for Channel 4 television in Britain called Beirut to Bosnia, How Muslims Are Coming to Hate the West. And in one scene in 1992, I walk into a burning mosque in the village of Chela in Serb-occupied Bosnia. I'd been there a year before, met the imam in his house, visited his very beautiful little square mosque, and the Serbs had promised then to protect it. Now it was on fire and the imam had disappeared. And as I walk into the mosque, you hear my voice on the soundtrack. And I say, I'm quoting myself exactly, when I see things like this, I think of the area where I live, the Middle East, where when violence occurs, we call it mindless terrorism. But when I see things like this, I say on the soundtrack, I wonder what the Muslim world has in store for us. Maybe I should end each of my reports with the words, watch out. 1992. When Victoria Fontan, my researcher, went back and tracked through the cuts in the film, she found that I walked into that burning mosque on the 11th of September, 1992, just 9 years too short. In the subsequent broadcast, Canadian television once or twice with Amy Goodman on the radio of the United States and British television, I found little references in interviews with me where I kept saying to people, it's not that good in the Middle East. I know Israel's got another treaty, a peace treaty, but there's an explosion coming. I used twice that phrase, there's an explosion coming. I didn't know, I knew nothing. But living in the Middle East, I felt it. I knew something was going to burst, something was going to happen. It was interesting that when my film series was shown on the Discovery Channel, the American press largely derided it on the grounds that it was sensationalist and that Muslims were not coming to hate the West. They saw no reason for any frustration. On September 11th, 2001, I was crossing the Atlantic on my way to America. Just before we took off, I'd received a call from the features editor to tell me that for the second time, a long investigation which I conducted into the Sabra and Shatila massacres of September 16th, 18th, 1982 had been postponed. The second reason, he said, was because a light aircraft had flown into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. Damn, I said. My investigation, in fact, proved fairly conclusively that while 800 Palestinians were killed between the 16th and the 18th of September, 800 others had been handed over as prisoners by the Israelis who had questioned them back to the Falangist murderers who took them away and held them hostage for 2 weeks in an attempt to use them as bargaining chips to get back Falangists who had been taken prisoner by Muslims. When they didn't get their prisoners back, all 800 Palestinians were executed into mass graves. We know the location of one of them in East Beirut. This story, then, was suddenly not going to run. Then, of course, my mobile phone rang again, and it was an airliner that had hit the tower of the World Trade Center. And then, of course, I could understand there'd be no Sabra and Shatila investigation in the paper that night. Then it was a second plane, and I realized this is not a tragedy, this is an attack. We took off, and I was using the satellite phone in the business class seat, talking to the office again and again, three aircraft, the Pentagon, four aircraft, one crashed in Pennsylvania. So I went up to the crew at the front of the aircraft and said, you better tell the captain, I don't know how much of this he knows. And the captain came back immediately, he'd only heard of one aircraft. So I told him about the others, he asked more information, I called London again. It was a very eerie situation to be flying towards America high over the North Atlantic, talking to someone in London about something that was happening in New York and Washington. And the stewardess at the front of the aircraft said, there must have been a lot of people involved. They must have made dummy runs. She said, where did the planes come from? And at this stage, we didn't know they were domestic flights taking off from Newark and Boston and so on. They could have come from Latin America, Europe, Africa. And the purser and I looked at each other. And we went round the plane together with a little piece of paper, looking for passengers we didn't like, of course. I found 13, two in business class. He found 14. Most of them were identical, the seat numbers. Of course, they were Muslims, weren't they? They had darker skin, brown eyes. They were reading the Quran or using worry beads or looking at me suspiciously because I was looking at them suspiciously. And I realized that in just two minutes, Osama bin Laden, for I was sure he lay behind it, had turned nice, friendly, liberal Bob into a racist. I was racially profiling the totally innocent passengers on my aircraft. And it dawned on me then that one of the reasons for 9/11 was not to divide necessarily Muslims from the West or Muslims from Christians, whoever they are, but to divide the innocent from the innocent. I met bin Laden 3 times. The last time I met him, he said to me his last words in a camp on the top of a mountain in Afghanistan, a camp, of course, originally built by the CIA because he used to be on our side. He said to me, "Mr. Robert, from the mountain upon which you're sitting, we defeated the Soviet army and helped to destroy the Soviet Union." Exaggeration, but I thought that had some truth in it. Then he said, "And Mr. Robert, I pray to God that he permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself." And my notebook of that conversation, because I've gone through all the notebooks, I've written at the time 3 vertical lines on each side of the paragraph where I quote that last sentence. And wrote in the margin, "Rhetoric? Question mark." I shouldn't have put the question mark. I shouldn't have put the rhetoric. When I got back to Europe and turned on the television set, obviously the plane turned around when America closed its airspace, and saw the Twin Towers coming down in that biblical horror, that fog of smoke and dust spreading over lower Manhattan, I remember thinking, well, now New York is a shadow of itself. But the big question for journalists that night, in the hours that immediately followed September 11, was the question, why? We were allowed to ask the question, who? 19 Arabs who claimed they were Muslims. We were allowed to ask, how? Box cutters, aeroplanes, tall buildings. But the moment we asked why, the world exploded around journalists. Because to ask the question why, we were quickly informed, was to be on the side of terrorism. That night, I was asking the question why a lot on radio and television, as I was in the first report I filed to my newspaper from the aircraft. And I ended up on an Irish radio show with a professor from Harvard who shall remain nameless. It was Alan Dershowitz, of course. And he came on, I asked the why question. He said, "Mr. Fisk is a dangerous man. To ask the why question, to ask why, means you're on the side of terrorists, you're anti-American, and to be anti-American is the same as to be anti-Semitic." That's what he said. And I remember thinking, I think I've got the message now. I think I've got the message. If we're going to look in the context of the Middle East, we're Nazis. Indeed, postcards followed, most of them from the United States, after this broadcast, and after I wrote about the broadcast, of course, which said that my mother was Adolf Eichmann's daughter. My mum, by the way, was in the Royal Air Force in 1940, repairing radios on damaged Spitfires during the Battle of Britain, but it doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is that, as the late Edward Said said, America's relationship with the Middle East, with both Arabs and Israelis, is the one taboo subject left in America. You can talk about gays, blacks, lesbians, anything you want, but don't let's get involved in the United States policy in the Middle East. Of course, if you look at, well, there's no crime in Berkeley, but if you look at any crime anywhere in America, the first thing the cops do is look for a motive. But when we had an international crime against humanity in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, the one thing we were not allowed to do was look for a motive. Like 19 guys, these are Arabs, these men. They come from the Middle East. Is there a problem out there? No, Israel was not responsible for September 11, 2001. But the environment from which these men came needs to be closely scrutinized. What happened in the Middle East? What have we been doing in the Middle East? What are we doing there now? These were questions that were not meant to be asked, and largely were not, and certainly largely were not in the mainstream press in this country or on television. They hated us because of our freedom, because we're good. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. We'll switch it off there. Thank you very much. You know, the strangest thing about all this in the aftermath of it was that if you go back in the history books and start researching through even the story of Iraq, you come across the most extraordinary, prescient ghosts of the future, as I call them. In writing about Iraq for my book, I went right back much, much earlier to the British invasion of Iraq in 1917. Actually, the first invasions of our sort of modern Europe came when Napoleon took the French expedition to Egypt in the 18th century. When he did, by the way, he issued a proclamation to the people of Cairo saying he was coming to free them from the pashas who were hanging those of them who wanted free speech. General Angus Maud was Commander-in-Chief British Army Mesopotamia and arrived in Baghdad in the autumn of 1917. British troops conquered all of Iraq. He put on the wall of Baghdad a poster, proclamation to the people of the Muhafazat, the governorate of Baghdad. A young soldier, Private Charles Dickens of the Cheshire Regiment, thought it might be important one day, so he peeled one off, put it in his rucksack, where it remained for 2 years, stained with his perspiration of the Iraqi summer heat, and eventually passed it on to his daughter, who, in February of 2003, sold it to me at auction for $2,000. And I framed it, and it stood framed beside my desk as I wrote The Great War for Civilization. Proclamation to the people of the governorate of Baghdad, General Maud wrote. We come here not as conquerors, but as liberators, to free you from generations of tyranny, it said. Sound familiar? General Angus Maud, not George W. Bush, Angus Maud. He died a few days later because he didn't boil his milk, cholera. His grave, by the way, is now in the British War Cemetery, at Northwall War Cemetery in Baghdad. We didn't have refrigeration in those days. Our soldiers lie where they died, in Iraq. I went into that cemetery this August, take pictures of their graves, 18, 19, 20, 21, the same ages as your soldiers and our soldiers who are coming back dead from Iraq today. And while I was there, American military patrol came into the cemetery and started walking through the long grass. You have to be very careful when you approach Americans in Baghdad at the moment, in case they think you're a suicide bomber. So my usual tactic is to have a big pipe in my mouth. I don't think insurgents smoke pipes in Iraq, and say, "Good morning, gentlemen." It tends to work. The sergeant turned around and said, "Good morning, sir." I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "We're looking for weapons." And I said, "Don't you think you should read the gravestones? Because in 1920, an insurgency began against the British occupation of Iraq. It began with the assassination of a British officer called Leachman at a village called Khandari, near Abu Ghraib, our favourite prison. And I know Khandari very well, because I went to Khandari in 2003 to report on the first death of an American soldier by a roadside bomb. His blood was still on the road. And I also met the grandson of the man who shot Colonel Leachman in 1920. And he said, yes, he died 100 feet away from the road where the American has just died. In 1920, the British took their retaliation upon the Iraqi insurgents by bombarding with artillery a city called Fallujah. In 1920, later the same year, the British army surrounded the holy city of Najaf and demanded the surrender of a Shiite cleric called Badr, not Sadr, Badr. In that same year of 1920, British military intelligence in Baghdad sent a telegram to the War Office in London, what's now the Ministry of Defence. Terrorists, they said, were crossing the Iraqi border from... Yes, Syria. Spot on, that's what it said. David Lloyd George, British Prime Minister in 1920, according to the Times Parliamentary Report, which I looked up and quote in my book, told the British Parliament that if British troops leave Iraq now, there will be civil war. Yeah, that's what he said. It's fingerprint, identical history. Quite extraordinary to go back and read this. We didn't read it, of course. We didn't read it before March and April of 2003. None of us did. It would have helped, wouldn't it? Maybe Tony Blair could have said, George, look, there is this little problem we had there before. But no, we were going... I should add, I mean, it's actually much more powerful than this. Prisoners, Turkish prisoners, who in fact were Arab prisoners in the Ottoman army, were taken to prison camps in India where they were abused by their guards. There are more parallels still. In Basra in 1916, British intelligence told the British government that the British army would be welcomed with flowers and cheers when we entered Baghdad. I mean, it is absolutely word perfectly the same. What do we say about Iraq now? The Americans must leave. The Americans will leave. And the Americans can't leave. And that's the equation that turns sand into blood.
This was the first half of a one-hour talk by the journalist, author, and Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, Robert Fisk. His new book, The Great War for Civilization, is a compilation of 30 years of reporting laid down in the context of a vivid and scholarly narration of history. Come back for the second half of this talk, when Fisk raises the question why American military is now in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Turkey, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Oman, Yemen, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, and in Saudi Arabia. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio recording or a film on DVD of this talk by Robert Fisk. You can find more information on Robert Fisk on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape, CD, or DVD order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your film or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.